You are listening to Believe, Strive, Achieve, Endurance Podcast with Diogo Custodio. If this is your first time listening, then thanks so much for coming. Get ready and enjoy the show.
Hello everyone, welcome to the Believe, Strive, Achieve, Endurance Podcast. My name is Diogo. Today I have Philip Hatzis with another special guest. Philip, welcome back.
Hi Diogo, how are you?
I'm very good, how are you?
All good, thank you. Not too bad at all.
So, Philip, who we have today with us?
So, I have got an athlete to join us today, and it's an interesting story. I caught sight of an Instagram story of one of my friends from university, and she'd said, congratulations to one of her friends. And I actually thought that she might have been crewing or anything, but she wasn't. But one of her friends who had just completed the Northern Channel. And that interested me for two reasons. One, because I had no idea what the Northern Channel was as a thing. And second of all, when I started looking into this a little bit more, the swimmer was actually a para athlete. So has only got one leg, lower limb of the leg has been amputated. And I also had no idea what this Northern Channel was, but essentially it's like the Channel swim. But up in the north between Ireland to Scotland. And I was really interested by that for obviously those two areas. But second of all, having just had the conversation, and if you haven't listened to it already, I'd definitely say go and have a listen to the conversation that I had with Carmen around, open water swimming. And as you go longer and longer and longer in that open water event, that was kind of really interesting. And this was a follow on from that. So I was already kind of intrigued by this one. And then started chatting and finding out a little bit more. And not only is the athlete a phenomenal athlete over distance swimming and obviously a para athlete on top of that, but he also competes in ice swimming, which I had to put on a couple of extra layers and read and find out a little bit more about as well. So I'm kind of really looking forward to the conversation.
That looks a little bit scary, to be honest with you. How long is the channel, just for curiosity?
So I think that the Northern Channel is further than the channel, the Southern Channel, if you like, the classic English channel, which people know about between England and France. So it's a little bit further. Obviously, conditions are likely to be a little bit cooler and colder because of the fact that it's up in the slightly further north. So, it's a slightly different beast, really.
Okay. And what kind of temperatures we can expect it?
There's two parts, I think, to the conversations that we're going to have. The first part is definitely around this, the idea of swimming, just generally, the open water swimming, again, talking about it much like we did with Carmen, exploring that that sport, if you like, where you go further with these open water distance swims across channels, across big sections of water. So there's going to be that part of the conversation. And then the other part of that is this ice swimming, which I have only just started brushing the surface on in terms of what in the world is ice swimming. because obviously from my perspective, ice is solid and swimming is usually done in liquid, so this is a bit harder. But having done a quick bit of research, ice swimming is anything where you swim in water without a wetsuit, which is less than 5 degrees warm, cold, depending which way you look at it. So that's what ice swimming is, and as I said, the two would be definitely slightly different conversations.
I know a guy who will love that kind of temperature in the water.
I think you and I would not be one of those people. But let's see how this unfolds. As I said, you're looking at so many different dimensions of this athlete. I think it's going to be a fascinating conversation, and I'm really looking forward to getting into detail a bit more and asking some questions, because this is definitely pushing me outside of my knowledge and comfort zone when it comes to temperatures, for sure. So yeah, looking forward to the conversation.
Let's go for it then. Thank you so much. See you guys in a minute.
Hello everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Believe, Strive, Achieve Endurance Podcast. And I'm joined today by a GB para athlete in ice swimming. Someone who's just completed the Northern Channel swim, which some of you may not even know exists, has completed the Channel swim, which more people know about as part of a relay, has the world record for the longest ice mile swum by a para athlete, which was actually even longer than a nautical mile, so about 2 kilometers long. And I guess as an all-round adventurer with cross-country skiing, triathlon, amongst other sports that he can boast about too. From a more pragmatic perspective, though, he's also heavily involved in ice swimming as the vice president of the International Ice Swimming Association and also part of the advisory board for the World Open Water Swimming Association. So he is definitely somebody who is very qualified to talk to us about open water swimming, about safety around swimming, around how to engage communities and people who may be less confident about jumping into the open water than pretty much anyone I've ever spoken to before. So I'd like to introduce you to John T. Warnikin, and welcome, John T. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
So, I mean, I saw the story of how I kind of came aware of you. I saw on Instagram, one of my friends posted this, I can't remember if it was a video or a few images about you completing the Northern Channel. And I first of all wanted to know what in the world the Northern Channel was. But let's kick off with that, because that's your most recent, as I understand it, most recent adventure. You swam the Northern Channel solo, and you're the first para swimmer to ever do that. So yeah. A little bit of information about what that channel is and how it came about.
The North Channel is the old, I think it used to be called the Irish Channel. And it's basically the body of water that separates Northern Ireland or Ireland from Scotland and Isle of Man and England. And the North Channel it makes up part of the seven channel swims to do what is known as the Ocean Seven. So if you swim the seven classic channel swims, which is English Channel, Gibraltar Straits, Cook Straits in New Zealand, North Channel, Catalina, which is off the coast, west coast of America, and then I can't get the pronunciations. There's the Molokai, which is, I think it's Hawaii, and then there's the Japan Strait, which is north to south islands of Japan, and they make up the Ocean Seven. And there's not many people at all who have done that. The North Channel is the one that you go from Northern Ireland, a place from Dungagadee. Robbie's Point is the usual start point, and you swim to Port Patrick, just near Stranraer, on that, I think it's an isthmus is the technical geography thing. You swim to Port Patrick, and it's just slightly longer than the English Channel.
And I guess that's a surprising bit when I was looking into it, because so many people have heard about the English Channel. And I remember chatting a long time ago to a friend of mine who is yet to have done the English Channel, but he said, I would like to do that. And he said, fewer people have swum the English Channel than climbed Everest. And now I think Everest is almost, that's definitely overdone it. But I guess even fewer people have ever gone anywhere near the Northern Channel.
Yeah, I think my number, I'm the 135th person to have swum it solo, the 80th man and the first para swimmer. So I would describe the North Channel in climbing terms as sort of the K2. It's the swimmer's channel. It's the swimmer's swim. You know, it's the tougher one. It's colder, more dangerous, funnier currents, nastier jellyfish. So it's sort of the swimmer's one, whereas the English Channel is the Everest of open water swimming. There's nothing easy about channel swimming. There's nothing easy about the English Channel. The North Channel just takes it to that slightly a little bit more difficult place to go and play.
And I guess the obvious question then is that it sounds like you're already looking ahead to the channel, I think, this summer.
Maybe. Yeah, the great thing, you know, the great thing about being, sort of known in, certainly in the ice world, and there's a lot of crossover between ice swimmers and endurance and sort of the more extreme side of endurance, is that people say to you, John, can't see this, or have you heard about it? You go, that could be interesting. there are a number of swims on the discussion table at the moment. There's one swim that I want to do with my swim partner Jackie, which is in Finland, called the downhill swim, and it's a wetsuit swim. It's about 20 odd k down a river, and it just looks beautiful. So that, you know, that would be a fun swim. If we can get onto that, that would be fabulous. Actually, I've got to email them. So there are those, and then there's some other swims that I'm looking at the moment. The English Channel is always, you know, is on the list to be done at some stage, but there's some other swims that I want to do beforehand.
Interesting. So how did you get into swimming?
just, you know, like most kids who grew up in the countryside, it was basically a necessity because, you know, your mother kicked you out of the house at, you know, after your breakfast and was told to come back at tea time and make sure there wasn't a policeman, you know, attached to you. And, you know, I grew up in the Yorkshire Dales and, you know, we mucked around in rivers and it was a necessity to keep you alive because, you know, boys will be boys and we do stupid things when we're young. So, you know, I learned to swim in Harrogate and in the old swimming pool, which is called Coppice Valley Swimming Pool. And, you know, like most of my peers who I grew up with, we all learned to swim. And we used to swim in rivers and fish and, you know, skim stones and, you know, have that sort of wonderful, carefree, wild, running, feral childhood, which is just, you know, which was just lovely. So that's how, you know, how I sort of started swimming and why we started swimming. Mum always swam. She was not a professional swimmer, but she's always enjoyed swimming and swam at school and that sort of thing. So, you know, to me and my brother, it's just, you know, we just, like most of our mates, we all swam. You know, it's just one of those things.
And I guess many people, when they think about young swimmers, they always think about that competitive pool-based environment. Was that anything that you did as a youngster? Were you very much always swimming, wild swimming, essentially, in the open water?
I was always playing rugby. That's what I was doing. From the age of 7, all I did was play rugby. And then, at school, they made sure the rugby players who could actually float do some swim training. And a lot of us could swim, and we were good swimmers because we were fit. So, you know, we went into the swimming team as well as play rugby. So, you know, I'm not a, you know, I don't consider myself to be a good swimmer. You know, I'm not a, you know, people, some of the people I swim with, you know, swim nationals and internationally and that sort of thing. And you can see that even, you know, even at master's level, you know, the quality is there. Whereas I didn't do that. You know, I swam at school in the school swimming team because I was reasonably okay. I was better at breaststroke than front crawl. But my focus from the age of 7 to the day I lost my leg was playing rugby for England. That was it. You know, that's all I cared about.
And obviously you did lose your leg at a young adult stage in life. So you had to relearn everything you were wanting to do sport-wise. And I guess swimming is no different. But how did that kind of translate from swimming and, well, just generally as a sportsman, because you're clearly very talented in sports and love sport as a, that was your passion. How did that kind of come across for you in terms of learning what you had to do and how you had to move and everything?
So swimming with one leg and the other bits of me that don't particularly, like my right, I nearly lost my right leg. My right ankle is pinned and heavily arthritic and doesn't really move very much. And my shoulders aren't particularly great from rugby and car crashes and ski crashes and all of that. So the thing about swimming and what I would say to your listeners is, if you want to swim triathlon, Ironman, that sort of stuff, or you know, the lakes, you know, or some of the channels, you can be as fit as a butcher's dog, but unless you get your technique sorted out, you're going to go nowhere in reality. And you know, swimming is about technique. It really is. That's how we can do these endurance swims. It's because our technique is reasonably okay. You know, my technique is pretty okay, my swim technique. And that's taken a lot of hard work and lessons and to get it to that point. And the amputation and the knackered right ankle is just part of that process, is working out how we can get to an efficient swim technique, albeit with a different body shape to what you may, you know, that you may, your swim technique, it may be pretty awful because of another reason. And you know, it's just working it out, and it's going with coaches who are used to dealing with people who you know are not that sort of atypical swim shape and come from that sort of competitive background, where they can see what you're trying to do and they will adapt the stroke to make it as efficient as possible through the water. And that's what I did, you know.
That makes a lot of sense as well, because if you think about the average office bound person who's not done a huge amount of sport, they probably are less athletic than you are as an amputee. You know, they'll have different restrictions that will not facilitate a swimming stroke. So I guess it's just finding the best and optimal solution for the individual.
Yeah.
I'm really interested, and I know you've documented sort of what happened. You were in a car accident, and as a result of that, you then had to have your leg amputated. The bit which I was actually more interested about the conversation was, it was an informed decision. So it was your decision to make to get rid of your leg.
Yeah.
And I'm just interested in that thought process, because you were a young man. I think you'd been in the military.
Yeah.
And you were, you know, aspirations to play sport for England.
Yeah.
And you know, all those things going for you, and then you had to make a decision which you knew would change your life, but also change the life that you knew and love, and the activities that you could do. And I'd be really interested in how you went through that decision at that very key time.
So this is going to sound a bit harsh. The way that I think is that I can't bring emotion into this, because if I bring emotion into this decision process, I'll never decide to have my leg off. So it stops being an emotional decision. No one wants to lose a piece of their body. You know, that's just, you know, just crazy. You just don't want to do it. So you have to remove the emotion. And I've been in hospital. I crashed on the 29th of November, 94. I was still in hospital at this time. This was sort of May. And we managed to save my right leg, albeit with quite a few problems in it, but we saved it. My left leg just wouldn't heal. And you get to a point, you know, I had my head rebuilt and all of my nose and my face, and that had all sort of healed. And I knew I was going to have another operation in a year's time to sort out the other pieces within it that needed sorting out. So you're lying in hospital and you think, my left leg's not healing. And I know I play tight head prop, but there is a brain in my head somewhere. And you do come to a realization that the outcome for this is not going to be the one that I'd hoped for. And, you know, I can tell you a story. They cut a piece of flesh out of my leg the size of my ear without anesthetic, because it was dead, and that really hurt. But, you know, I knew that if I got a black piece of flesh in my left leg, yeah, that's not good. Waking up one morning and finding literally a pyramid appearing at the top. And when we pressed it, me and the nurse, and they were, you know, stop eating, literally a river of pus came out of the bottom hole that was unhealed in my leg, and it just gushed out. You start coming to the reality that, yeah, your leg is not a healthy piece of body at the moment, and to get it fixed is going to take a bit of a miracle. And I ended up going to Leeds, being sent to Jimmy's in Leeds. And they did all these tests, and they did nerve tests and vein tests, where they pump you full of radioactive stuff to see what's going on down in the leg and the nerves and all of that. And the surgeon came in, and it was quite, and he said, look, Jonty, this is your choices. You're going to have 5 operations over 3 years. We're going to break your leg at the top. We're going to cut out all of the dead bone. We're going to put in an external fixator, which you will then wind open every day. We will then at some stage swinging muscle from your back, veins and nerves from your left leg, and we're going to swing that in. It's going to take these 5 operations, 3 years, and I'll give you a 30% chance of feeling your foot, or you can cut your leg off. And I looked at him and I said, cut my leg off, because it had no longer become an emotional decision. It was a very simple, I didn't want to go through 3 years of being poked around and cut open and all of this for the remote chance of just being able to feel my foot. The payoff, the risk versus reward, is just not there. So it's just a logical thing is to say, cut it off. And he gave me that great salesman alternate close. He said, do you want it done? I think he said Thursday. And we're talking on a Tuesday or Monday. And I went, let's do it Monday. Give me some, you know, just give me time to get used to this. And actually we went home and we had a pre-leg wake on the Sunday. A load of mates came around and we sort of said goodbye to the leg. And I said to him, he said to me, is there anything I can do for you? I said, yeah. If you could save me 2 little bits of bone from my toes, I'd like to make a pair of cufflinks. And he said, okay, I'll do that for you, because that sounds like quite a good idea. And so Monday morning came. They wheel me down to theatre. You know, you've got arrows drawn on your legs to make sure they cut the right one off. He says to me, are you still good to go ahead with this? And I was like, yeah, this is the right decision. Anyway, so he takes my leg off. I wake up and various other things. They didn't tell me I was having an epidural, so I couldn't feel below my waist, and I was a bit concerned about that. But anyway, I'm lying there. He comes in to see him, and he said, look, if you want to do your leg rebuilt, it was rotten. I had to condemn it, so I couldn't even save the bits of bone to make some cufflinks. Your leg went into biohazard. If you'd wanted a rebuild, I'd have cut your leg off as soon as I'd gone into it. It started dying the day you crashed your car. So for me, it was fine. It was like I made the right call. I didn't go down to surgery thinking, well, this is the first operation of a series of five over 3 years and all of that, and then have the shock of waking up with no leg. I made the call. It was the right call. I was comfortable with the call. And for me, it was like, this is the start of the new life. And I remember looking down at the bed, you know, hospital blankets, where my full leg made the impression and my left leg didn't. And I was like, well, that's final. But you have to sort of understand, and you know, the deal you do with yourself is right. You have to draw that line in the sand that says the life that I was hoping to live, that I had busted my proverbial to be the best rugby player I could and try and be in the military to fly and all of that, that life is no longer going to occur. Well, it's, you know, it certainly wouldn't back then. Now it's slightly different, but back then it was like, not happening. Right, what am I going to do? And all I knew is my dad gave me some advice, which was, it's easier to get a job whilst you're in a job, so get a job. And the second thing was, I knew I had to get up, get mobile, start doing stuff straight away. As soon as I physically could, and as soon, you know, as my wounds would allow me, I had to get up and start. So, you know, I would try and hoover the downstairs of mum, because I was living back at home then. I would try and hoover the downstairs of the house with one leg on a crutch just to get back to some form of progress, normality. And I was going to limb center every pretty much four times a week to try and get a limb to fit, get used to walking, learn how to walk again, and see how my right ankle would behave with the limb, because obviously I trade off every day. If my ankle's killing me, then I put more pressure through my false leg. If my false leg's killing me, I'll pray to God that I can put the emphasis onto my right ankle. And, you know, so I just wanted to learn to walk. I had a friend's wedding in June, July, that I wanted to have two legs at. So that was the next first step, is like, I need to have it be on a leg for her wedding. And then it was like, I need to build up the fitness so I can then get a job or go to the job. And had been held open for me, which I started in December. And that's how I work. You know, it's, there's no point in looking back and saying, what if. I never say what if looking back. No, it's just, that just rots your soul. But I do say, what if I tried this? And I say yes a lot to do things. You know, mates who say, have you thought about, can you come and do this? Do you want to come and do a speed march with the Marines over the mountains? Yeah, why not? Sounds like a laugh. You know, I say yes a lot to do things, because that way, you just end up living a fantastic life.
I mean, there's a quote which jumps out at me, which is, the athlete is the mind and the body is purely the vessel. And I think that if you look at how you've lived your life so far, you know, it doesn't matter what, you know, how many legs you had. I think you would have lived a very similar lifestyle in terms of just go out, seize whatever a challenge you can try and do, and do it to the best of your ability. And I think that was really echoed in, well, I need to get moving and to get, you know, hoovering being the next sort of task and trying to build up from it. I think there's a lot of parallels there that anyone who has, you know, a little niggle here or injury or anything like that, it's, yeah, okay, fine, it's happened. And what can you do next to try and make things move forwards rather than dwelling in the background of what happened and what could have been?
Yeah, because that gets you nowhere. You know, I was, as I said, I like skiing, and I was trying to go and do this ultra on skis in the Arctic, and I ended up getting COVID on the survival course, which is a whole different story. But people were saying to me, John, aren't you worried about it? I was like, what am I worried? Why am I worried? Well, you know, you've got one leg, and, you know, I don't have to worry that I'm going to get frostbite in my left toes. You do. I don't. I just have to worry that if it gets too cold, that the oil in my false leg doesn't freeze. But I've got that. I've spoken to the manufacturers, or my prosthetist has spoken to the manufacturers and says I'm good down to minus 50. So, you know, it's a different way. It's just a different way of looking at life. Or some of us look at life in a slightly different way. I was watching a documentary the other day, and this
guy who was a left leg, I think he was a left leg or right leg amputee, and he was talking about people climbing Everest, and he said, basically said, I could never do that. And I'm thinking, why not? You know, I'd quite happily. Yeah, someone said to me, would you climb Everest? Well, the answer is I wouldn't, because I made that deal with my wife. There's certain things I'm not allowed to do. But, you know, someone said, do you want to climb Everest? And I hadn't made that deal with Penny. Then the answer is, yeah. Because you just have to figure these things out. You just have to go, okay, I can't do it like that, but I can do it like that. And I know there's a guy who's got no legs and he's been up Everest, so I could maybe get in touch with them. And, you know, you just work things out in a different way. And why not, you know?
Same. Why not indeed?
Yeah.
So going, I guess, forward a little bit, you got yourself into ice swimming, which for those of us who are envisaging how in the world you swim through an ice block, do you want to just explain a little bit about the actual definitions of ice swimming? Because there's some kind of key...
Yeah, so ice water is deemed 5 Celsius or less. So swimming in ice is deemed 5 Celsius or less. And the swimming that we do is all skins. So we wear one costume, one hat, goggles, nose clip and earplugs, should you wish. And there's two parts. There's the adventure side of the sport, which the ice mile is part of. So the ice mile is to become a full member of the International Ice Swimming Association, you've got to swim 1 mile swim, 5 degrees below, without a wetsuit. And it's not a race, that's an accomplishment. It's like going up Everest. No one races up Everest. It's just do it. And, you know, and everyone is equal. You do the ice, you do the mile, you're equal. And then we do other, you know, there are other swims. You know, Rambakai, the chairman, you know, takes people down to Antarctica. They swim up within the Arctic Circle. And we're looking at other, he's got some other swims planned in, you know, really quite, you know, panoramic areas. And that's the sort of thing the adventure side looks at. But the other stated goal of the Ice Swimming, International Ice Swimming Association, is we want to get this sport into the Winter Olympics. And so we race. And racing... We race 1K is our sort of flagship distance. Whoever is the quickest male and female become king and queen of the ice. So we race the 1K, 500s, 250s, 50s, 100s, and then we also do a 4x250 country relay, which is mixed. You have to have male and female swimmers within that. And we've done 5 world championships. We've got the 6th one coming up in 2 years' time in a place called Morvino in Italy. And we've got the first world champion, European world championships, coming up in Romania in February. And, you know, we will have 400 or 500 swimmers from 30 to 40 nations swimming really competitive swims, swim times in the ice. And if you, I'm not up to date on the thing, but if you want to swim 1K and look to be competitive as a bloke, you're looking at 11 minutes and a bit of change if you want to do it. You know, and that water can be 2 degrees, 1 degree. You know, this is fast swimming. And then we have the para side of it. And, you know, it's been quite a lonely place for me for the last 9 years, because not many paras have come into it. And now we're getting more para swimmers into it. So one of the proudest things I've ever done was In the World Championships this year that we had in Samoa in France, I put together the first 4x250 para relay, and we raced against the country relays. And I had, there were 3 ladies and myself, Patricia from Ireland, who's profoundly deaf, Nikki Durham, who's got also from Ireland, absolutely smashed leg, Tina Deacon is this legendary para swimmer from Germany, and myself. And we went up against all the country teams. And it was just, God, you know, I was the weakest link. I was in bits, actually. And we got this lovely video that the marketing team for the International Ice Swimming Association, team from Marketing Adventures, did of us, of the preparation that and what we did as a team. And, you know, it's probably one of the proudest things I've done. It was getting that, you know, we're equal, we're racing. And the French were bloody brilliant. You know, I went to the board and said, look, I'm trying to put this together. They were like, brilliant, brilliant. It's all about inclusivity in the ice. Go and speak to the French. And because I'm, you know, one of the vice presidents, I'd already been out there. So I knew the organizers, they all knew me. We had meetings anyway during the week. And I said, look, I want to do this. And they said, okay, we will try our best. I said, look, can we swim as world para, because we had the system for the, I think, for, that they're going to use in the Olympics, the timing system and the computer system, and it lists all the countries, and there's no country of world para. So we're like, well, who are we going to swim under? We're going to swim under Ireland, as we've got two Irish swimmers. And anyway, to cut a long story short, they came back to me the next day and they said, John, we've adapted the system and you're swimming country zero code, world para. And, you know, that meant so much to the four of us that, one, this crazy extreme sport will accept para swimmers as equals. And not only that, they will do their bust, their proverbials, everyone working to make sure that they can compete on a level playing field with the fastest ladies and gents ice swimmers in the world. And it was just magical. It was just such a great race. So yeah, that's ice swimming.
And I guess that totally echoes your own personal motto, really, of why not?
Yeah.
You know, what's the actual problem from getting an extra team into the relays? There's nothing there which limits it other than a country code. So let's solve that.
Yeah, and a big bit of coding from the French software people, which is brilliant. And you know, I now chair the inclusion committee for the ice swimming, and one of the conversations we had recently was, do we want to have a separate identity and a separate? And I'm like, no, we swim together. This is one big ice family, and so what matters, the way we swim, is we know roughly what our times are going to be, and the heats are then built to those people with similar times. So you can be in a heat with, you know, an amputee next to you, and then, you know, three other able bodies and maybe a lady, and then the system will then work out your age group, you know male, female, and all of that. And that's what we love about it, is that we're just part of the family, and we don't want this separate identity. What we need to do is just split out the classification so the result bit is equal, but when it comes to the swimming bit, we all swim together with, usually within the masters. I mean, if we had a super speedy amputee or whatever disability who was, you know, who could challenge the able-bodied, they would swim in the elite able-bodied race. Why wouldn't they? Because that's the way ice swimming works, and it's just fabulous.
And what was your motivation to get into ice swimming, aside from you grew up swimming while and everything else? But I mean, I'm half Greek. I also have Scottish blood in me, which makes me kind of think I'm confused. But the idea of getting into freezing cold water, and those people who know me are like, yeah, he probably wouldn't do it. But you know, what motivated you to get into that freezing cold water? And what was the
there's a theme the calling? That will develop, and it was because no disabled person had swum an ice mile, so I wanted to be the world's first to do it, and that's. I was swimming when I moved back up from London. I lived in London. I used to swim down there, and all the lakes were shut at about 14 degrees C. The Yorkshire Lake stayed open, so when I came back, it's like the lakes are open. So I went swimming, and I was in a wetsuit, and my new coach up here, she said two things to me, and she was right. She said, you know, you can swim the ice, and you can swim the channel. We didn't on the channel side necessarily envisage the North Channel, but yeah. I said to her the other week, you know, nothing wrong with starting with the tough one. But she said, you can swim the ice. You can get out of your wetsuit. And so we did. And then we realized no disabled person has swum this ice mile, which was 10 years ago. You know, less than 100 people had done it when I did it. And of course, I wanted to be the world's first. So we trained in secret, messaged RAM and said, look, has anyone done this? No, right, we're going to do this. And that's what sort of got me through the ice mile. And then we were racing in winter swimming. Colin Hill used to run a big winter swim thing called the Chilled Swim up at Windermere in January. So we swam in that. And then I love the challenge of ice swimming. I find it so hard, but it's so enjoyable once you've done it. I just love that. I love that yin and yang.
And aside from the obvious of just getting in, but what sort of is the process for somebody actually to start? So say I've overcome my Greek blood and I say, you know something, Jonty, I'm going to come join you. But how do you do it safely? How do you, you know, find out where to go? What's that process look like?
So where to go is look on the basically is contact, go to the GB ice swimming page on Facebook. A lot of this is done through Facebook. Got members of the GB board are dotted around the country and Scotland, or you can just contact me and say, look, I live here, I want to try ice swimming, who do I go to? It's a small world, we all know each other, and we know where to point people to if they're not in our region. So first of all, you need to find people who understand ice swimming and do it themselves. That's the really important. You need a coach who's done it or does it. The second thing is you need to understand that if you want to, you can just get in and swim five. I mean, it really doesn't matter. You know, winter swimming is similar. They just swim shorter distances and all of that sort of thing. Whereas the, you know, ice swimmers, we're looking to push the distances and race, which is a whole different stress on your body than just going in for a heads up breaststroke chat with your friends. And I'm not diminishing that. I sometimes love going in for a heads up chat with my mates. But the stress on the body doing that or doing a Wim Hof sitting in the ice water is that's like, for me, stress level 5%. Racing a 250 in the ice is 95% on the into the red zone. It is a whole different world. So go and find people that actually do this, coach it and understand it. The second thing is, if you want to do the distances and build up to your ice mile, you know, you have to be mindful about what's going on in your life. You can't go out the night before and get, you know, lashed up and all that, because you're gonna end up somewhere where you don't want to end up, which could be the hospital. You know, there are so many factors that matter that you only know about once you work out and you've done it yourself, to say that works for me, that doesn't work for me. Oh, that was, you know, that temperature didn't work for me, or that type of weather didn't work for me. So the things that matter, really, your nutrition, surprise, surprise, is massively important. Trying to do it on a keto, you know, a protein only diet, whatever they're called, just doesn't work. You know, good breakfast. A lot of us eat porridge before we get, you know, for breakfast before we go. That making sure you're not too tired. You know, family life can get in the way, and I don't mean that in a funny way. It's just like, if you're tired, the kids have been up playing, or, you know, around, or work's been stressful. All of that will have an influence. If you haven't eaten right during the week, some of us find that has an influence. The water temperature obviously matters. Air temperature matters. Is the sun out? Is it windy? Have you done too many of these swims during the week? Some of us find that our ice battery only recharges if we do one or two swims a week. Others can do sort of three or four, and it doesn't seem to affect them as much. But for me, my cold water tolerance, I can do like one or two, and then I just find it too painful. Injuries, past injuries, the metalwork in my ankle is torture. Anything below 3 degrees and it's literally torture getting in. And you pick up all of this and you talk to people and you see what works for them and what doesn't work for them and what works for you. But the really annoying thing is that season on season, it tends to change. So what you think worked for you last season, you try again, you know, new season, it's like, oh, that's not working. Damn, I have to find another a way of doing that. And yeah, you know, that keeps, to me, that's the really interesting side. And we have a medical committee that deals with all of the sort of the medical side of ice swimming, whether it's, you know, we have medicals before, we have to have a medical ECG sign off and all of that sort of stuff pre-season, so we know that our hearts are good and can stand what the season's going to throw at us. And then we have this massive discussions on best way of recovering ice people from a frozen, you know, a cold / frozen lake. And we have, you know, our medical committee's got doctors and professors on it who understand this. And we're all learning. You know, when we started, we thought a 2K ice mile was extreme. And now we've got guys, you know, I think the current record for the distance is 6K in skins. You know, it's remarkable. So what we know is that we don't know. We know we don't know a lot, you know, but what we do know, there are certain themes that we know work and keep people safe. And it's the usual things as well. Don't swim alone. Certainly don't do ice swimming alone. Don't push distances and stuff like that. you know, make sure you recover, make sure you immediately get out of the cold, the wet, pat yourself down, don't rub yourself down, get warm, get dry, get a hot drink, hot sugary drink in you, all of those sorts of things. Don't go straight from the cold into a sauna or a jacuzzi, because that can cause you some issues. It's learning the processes, the protocols, and getting your, you know, if you're changing by the side of a lake or a river, and it's cold and wet, and you know, you need to have your process of getting dry out and dry and as quickly as possible. You know, all your kit is laid out in a way. You may wrap it in a hot water bottle so it's warm when you put it on. You know, these little things that don't matter maybe in the summertime really start to matter when the water is at 2 degrees and the air temperature is at 2 degrees and it's blowing a gale. So it's doing that with people who can point you in the right direction. So that's not a good thing to do. Or, you know, you need to make sure that you get that bit of the process squared away so you can get dry, get out of the elements as quickly as possible.
What I find fascinating by especially that early part of the list where you were talking through, these are things that could potentially impact your performance essentially in the swimming, in the ice swimming session you were doing at the weekend. So, you know, your family, what you're eating, kind of all those other aspects. These are all things that as a coach, we're flagging up to athletes all the time, saying if you do these things, if you're not aware of how your body is responding to life stresses, to give them a big catch-all, you're going to see that you're not going to perform as well when it comes to that session, or that might kind of pay into it a little bit and you'll find yourself a little bit more tired than you might otherwise be. Whereas for you, those are the marginal differences between actually being able to do the whole session comfortably or potentially be in some serious trouble.
Yeah.
And that margin for error is really, really small, but you're highlighting all those things that for, as I said, all endurance athletes should be aware of having an impact, but for you, the impact's very, very acute.
It's acute, it's quick, and it's obvious. I pulled myself out of the swim because I just didn't feel right. You know, it's because I've been on a diet and I this high protein stuff, and it just wasn't, you know, I got in and I got literally 30 meters into the swim and I thought, yeah, I don't feel good here. I turned around, came back, my buddy Leon, who runs Swim Your Swim, was on the boat. He said, "Are you all right?" I said, just don't feel right getting out." Got out, got dressed, fine. Had a hot chocolate, all good. But I was then working out. I was like, "It's because I've been on this high protein diet." There is, you know, people when we do ice miles, you know, we have a boat next to them with guys in wetsuits, dry suits, and we talk to them. I'm usually on the shore observing with Leon. And we're looking at the swimmer, and we can tell if a swimmer's going to make it or not. We can see how much they're suffering from the shore. And we're talking to the boat, and the boat's talking to the swimmers. And I can tell you, because I've been on the boat as well, and you will have a swimmer that you think is, oh, you know, they're in stress, but they're not in too much stress. And then suddenly they go, and they literally drop like a stone. It is that instantaneous. They literally drop like a stone, and you're in, and you drag them out, and you get them ashore, and you sort of fine. And we've never need to call an ambulance or anything like that. But it is
the itself quite remarkable.
It is. And the thing is, you know, it's these little things that, as I said, don't matter in the summer, really do matter. The sun on your back, if it's one of those beautiful winter days, you know, that we all love, really matters. If that sun's out versus it's cloudy, you know, that's happy, happy. You know, that's a good time. If the water temperature's warmer than the outside, that makes you happy. I was swimming, and I'll show you how ridiculous that is. I was swimming in the south of France doing a canyon swim, one of my favorite swims, and I got in and it was 31 degrees air temperature, and I got into the sort of the lagoon and then started swimming up this canyon, and it got to about 13-14 degrees in the water according to my Garmin, and I started to get really, really cold, you know. And I was thinking, hang on, I'm an ice swimmer. And I came back and I was talking to my wife. And I said, I think, you know, there is this differential, water temperature versus air temp differential, I think is a massive thing. Not just in the summertime when you're, you know, lounging around in the Mediterranean, you put your foot in the sea, you go, oh, that's cold, when it's not. So that's why, you know, these little things about the sun on your back, and we will warm our fingers in the stroke as across the water before we plunge it back into the ice cold. That little bit of warmth can make all the difference to a successful swim. And that's why it's fascinating, because it really is interesting to see, you know, what matters and what doesn't matter when you're doing this sort of stuff.
These are very much the marginal gains, but life and death, I guess, really, from what many people know in terms of sport. One of the things you just said reminded me, I interviewed for one of the previous podcasts a swimmer called Carmen, who she actually swam Loch Ness, which I hadn't realised was longer than the English Channel, as well.
It's not the long,
or maybe a mile. It's a mile shorter, isn't it? It's still kind of comparable, which in my mind was blown. It doesn't seem like it's the same distance as the Channel or similar distances, but it is.
Yes,
she was talking about having sort of the two voices, the kind of the ones that you listen to and the ones that you can disregard. And she had a similar story to yourself, actually, where she was like, no, I don't feel quite right. And she pulled herself out and she was listening to the important voices. Whereas in the beginning, everyone's going to hear the thing saying, this is really cold, you should probably get out, because that's the immediate response your body will probably have when it goes into cold water and overriding. And I just was wondering how you've managed to learn kind of what to listen to, what your signals were, because everyone's going to have different tells, but what were your kind of, how did you get to the point where you could understand that quite so well for yourself?
This is going to sound really, it's just by swimming. It's understanding. So when I did my North Channel solo, the first hour is like, usually you're just getting into the swim. On any endurance swim, whether it's Ness or Windermere or Lomond or Roar or whatever, or the English. Hour 2 to 4 for me was pretty miserable. I shook my arm, my right arm, which it seems to I developed a bit of tennis elbow from swimming Windermere 2 weeks previously, was annoying me. And those doubts start coming into your mind because you're thinking, I've got another 14, 15 hours of this, and it's cold, and I haven't yet been stung by a jellyfish, which is going to make me more miserable. And then, to me, it's when your intelligence kicks in and says, hang on a minute, all I need to do is swim to swim to the next feed. So actually, all that matters is the next half an hour. Because once I get another bit of food in, I'll feel a bit warmer. Hopefully that's it sorts out the pain, and I'll be a bit happier, and my mind will be in a good place. And what you find, what I found is, and after finishing the swim, talking to my great friend Kate Steeles, who's done multiple different channels and is one of the queens of the ice. She's done all 7 ice miles on 7 continents, including a 0 ice mile. And I said to her, this channel swimming game, between hours 2 to 4, I felt pretty miserable, and like everything was like in a bit of a mood. She said, you get that, and then. Did you find that you just got into the rhythm of the swim? And I went, yeah. And you just get into this rhythm of, okay, I'm feeding every half an hour. So I feed. I know that straight after the feed, I'm going to feel pretty bleh for like 3 to 5 minutes. Then I'm going to enjoy myself. Then I'll start talking to the jellyfish and then maybe think about nothing. And then I look over at the boat and I can see my wife preparing the food again. And then next minute, the pole with my food and drink comes back out and you start the whole process again. And so your life becomes really quite rhythmic, and I love it. It's just really quite. It's a really happy place for me. And then you've got obviously you're moving your arms, so it's a bit like a Buddhist chant. It's just got that metronomic effect of you just get into this zone, and so you've got that going on, and then every 30 minutes that going on, and that's all you do. You swim to 30 minutes, and you look at the boat, and talk to the fish. Well, that's what I do. And that's it.
It's very mindful, I think. And sometimes, I think that's true for any endurance sport. When you talk to people, they go into it doesn't have to be super, super long distances. It can just be a period of long hours. You just get into that rhythm, that routine, you just dial into it and you're completely focused on the activity, but also you're not focused on the time that it takes to do the activity, that next feed station, carry on. And you just find that rhythm, almost kind of that zen-like state that you get into, which is always fascinating when you talk to other endurance athletes because they do know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And for non-athletes listening to this, it's the same thing if you're driving a car and you suddenly realise, where did that last 50 miles go? It's that sort of place that you get to. It's like, oh, well, that 30 minutes came round quick. Where did I, and that's what you're trying to me, that's where I'm trying to get to. Interesting enough, you don't seem to get that. When I've done channel relays,
and relay swims. You don't get that because you're in for an hour, so it's a fixed period. So you get in, you think, oh, this is cold and miserable. And then you swim, and then obviously you're not going to swim to a feed because you don't feed whilst you're swimming on relays. And then you think, oh, this is a bit of a grind. And then it gets to about 45 minutes. You're like, this is a bit of a grind, really is a bit of a grind. And then somebody will flash up a board saying 15 minutes to go, and you go, oh, great. And then you're back in a happy place, and then you get it back on board and you start that whole process again. So in some respects, solo swimming is easier because you know you're in till you hit land at the other side. And it just goes to show that a lot of this stuff, endurance-wise, whether it's swimming, cycling, triathlons, it really is in your head. It's how, is your head in the right place? And if it's not in the right place, you're unlikely to be successful in what you're trying to achieve. And we say that, that's, I think, is also very important to all athletes. When people beat themselves up, if they've had to pull themselves out of a swim or out of a run or out of a bike ride, we always say to them, the water's not going anywhere, so stop worrying about this. Put it down as a learning experience. Put it down as a training swim or a training ride. Don't beat yourself up about this because you've learned so much. You learn far more from failure than you do from success. So don't beat yourself up about it. Water's going nowhere. Work out what you need to change to be successful, and let's go again. And you know, and I think you know that's what we try and do.
And it's definitely apparent, and I think a lot of what you've done as well, and how you've approached the challenges that you have. I'm going to circle back round to something that you did say and kind of bring it up. But first of all, I'm really interested that your aim for para swimming was very much, I guess, that selfish one. You wanted to be the first swimmer to swim the ice mile.
Yeah.
However, a lot of what you're doing now comes across, you might tell me otherwise in a second, but comes across that actually you're really trying to enthusiastically, you're very energetic around getting other para swimmers, challenging their own comfort zones and getting them to do more. And that's obviously picked up a lot with the charitable work that you do, picking up the relay side of things. And the fact the proudest moment you've had to date was the relay that you did at the Ice Championships. Kind of, Is that a fair observation, that is where your passion is coming from now, actually try and break those boundaries and get other para athletes into sport? And
I like world firsts. I like doing world first swims. So my North Channel solo was the first para across. That's in some respects what motivates me in a very small sliver, because I do other swims that aren't world first because they've already been done. But I like looking for ones that have been done because I just find it amuses me. I like to have a funny life. So that just amuses me. The bit about getting para ice swimmers or people to come and swim endurance or people just to go open water swimming is about you can do this and it's you can be part of this family and you're an equal. You know, you go and swim an ice mile with one leg or one arm or with you know, if you're blind or whatever. And everyone who swum that ice mile knows that you have done what they've done and it's maybe a little bit more difficult for you. And so it's a real leveler. It's a really welcoming family and community because everyone knows that this is a tough place to come and play, irrespective of whatever. Plus, the racing side of it is, you know, racing a 50 meter, you know, in the ice or 100 meters, it's achievable. And I'd love more, you know, as a Brit, more British disabled Paralympians to come in and start thinking, you know, I can come and do stuff in the ice. Keaton Jones, who's an American Olympic quality swimmer, he got like 4 or 5 gold medals at our world championships in France. It's the first time he's come, and he's obviously been around professional swimming for all of his young life, and he says he couldn't believe how welcoming this family of ice swimmers were. He wrote about it saying it's the most welcoming community because everybody knows how tough it is. You know, in our sport, the pain is instantaneous. You get into that water before you've even started racing, I promise you, it hurts. And when we're in Russia and it's below zero, it properly hurts.
So there's this mutual respect. It's a bit like boxers, I assume. You know, anyone who gets into a boxing ring gets my uttermost respect because you know it's going to hurt. So there's that thing. And the para community is not only can they, you know, they can come and be within a community that is really welcome, but secondly, they can achieve so much stuff. Ice swimming is, you know, is still at the acorn stage, and para swimming is still even, you know, even further back than that, because there's four or five of us that went to the World Championships. You know, fingers crossed, we'll get more coming in the next ones. And so, you know, if you like racing and you like a challenge, there is no reason why we can't get you into the ice and get you out. And the most important thing about this is that we get you in and get you out safely. You know, safety is the critical bit in all of this. But, you know, I've only once had one disability where we couldn't. The doctor said, no, we can't race them. That was one disability. And that was because it was a fainting issue and passing out issue in cold water, which obviously is not great when you're swimming in ice.
Not really.
But, you know, everyone else, deaf, blind, amputees, paralyzed, there is no reason. Really is no reason.
And just to pick up something you said, before I do that full circle, leave it saying, you mentioned obviously the racing element is key. One thing that as a triathlon, general triathlon, non-ice triathlon, coach perspective, you know, we're always talking about getting into the water safely, kind of slowly and everything else. But for relays or for the ice competitions that you're doing, is that still starting from a deep water start essentially, or are you diving in, or how does that work?
Right. So for those who, you know, when we get into normal non-racing, you know, you need to acclimatize your body to get in. Now, I will acclimatize quicker than a newbie because my body goes, I know what he's doing, and I'm in. The problem with the thing about racing is we get in and we go. So you're acclimatizing, and as I mentioned earlier about, you know, sitting around doing Wim Hof is like 5% on the stress, and racing is 95%. And that's because you don't get time. Your acclimatization is part of the race, right? So,
yeah.
So you have to be, you know, you have to have got a bank of training and experience in, so your body goes, okay, I can deal with this, and I know, you know, I'm going to survive it. So, yes, for those who want to swim in any form of water, cold water or any, get in slowly, acclimatize before you start doing the swim, and then build your swim from that. When it comes to ice racing, we don't do that. We don't dive in. We took a decision not to dive in. We think that's too dangerous. So what we do is we get the great instruction, which is to take off your clothes. And as I'm usually ref the GB championships, and you know, you end up saying it to about, over the course of the weekend, about 50 different ladies telling them to take their clothes off. And literally you take the clothes off. You say, right, get off, take your clothes off. It basically gets rid of your changing robe, your dry robe, your Charlie McLeod. And then we tell them to get in the water. And one of the things we say to them is, if you try and game getting in the water, we'll set the race off. So don't try and be slow getting in, because it'll annoy the others that are already there. So you get in, you look at the referee, and bang, we get you going. And you need to be able to deal with that as a swimmer. And, you know, that is puts quite a considerable stress on the body if you're not used to it.
And then for the relay, I guess you get in as the swimmer's coming to the end, and then you jump in and then they go.
Channel relay.
Oh, no, so for the ice relays.
Ice relays, what we do. Yeah. So they're doing the, whether it's a 4x250 or a 4x50, is the swimmer goes off, first swimmer goes off, and when the other, if they do this, it's a 50 because we're in a 25 meter pool, they get to the top. By the time they got to the top, the second swimmer's gone down the ladder and is ready to go. They come back, second swimmer finishes, they exit the ladder, next swimmer gets in, and you rotate it that way. So it's all done by ladder. And obviously, one of the considerations we had when we were doing the 4x250, because the ladders can be quite short under the water because of how you build these ice pools, and that's a whole different discussion how we build these things. You know, we said to Tina and Nikki, who both have proper leg problems, you don't, if you need it, I'm sorry, but we're going to get a diver to push you from your bum and push you up the ladder. And they go, fine, you know, they're open water.
At that point, that's probably the least of their worries.
Just get me out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the reason I was first asking that point around that passion that you really have around others was because a lot of the way you operate does just resonate really, really well with, I think it's Dr. Angela Duckworth's grit. Right. So that idea of perseverance, I don't know if you come across that. So essentially, she did a lot of research into various organizations, the military, even parenting as well, actually, around what is grittiness and how do you nurture or create it. And a lot of it is around growth mindset and being able to focus on kind of a goal, and if you get knocked back or kind of put into different, you find another way around there, which definitely echoes as the way you've kind of operated. But the other bit which sits there is that every single one of the really gritty individuals that they identified in the research is actually someone who has a purpose which is greater than them. And that comes across again with yourself in terms of, you know, you are looking at trying to get more people into there's the selfish aspect of, well, I want to be the first person in the world to do that. But actually, the flip side of that is that the minute that you've done that, a bit like Roger Bannister and his breaking the mile record, you know, other people will then follow. And so, you know, if you are breaking tracks in the snow, that's fine because you're the person doing it. But a lot of what it's doing is probably selfless because it's bringing other people on. And it just the way you're operating really, really resonates about with the work that she's done on grittiness.
Yeah, that's very kind. And I think it comes back to somebody saying, you can do this. Like my old coach, Pauline Matthew, said to me, you can do the channel. Okay, we didn't think it was going to be the North. I think we were talking about the English. But you can do the channel. You can swim in the ice. You're built for this. You're built for channel swimming. You need somebody to recognize in you. I always say, I give talks on getting over adversity and sort of motivational speaking. And I say it to people that mirrors lie. I look in the mirror, you know, and I'm my worst person for thinking, you know, having the doubts and all of that. And what I see in the mirror that comes back to me and what you see or my swim coaches or my swim partner sees is different. And they see what I can do and all I do, because I know me best, is I just see me as somebody who I can't possibly, I'm not, you know, that, not FOMO, what's the other one? Imposter syndrome. And I think that's quite a big part of it. And you need those people around you to say, Jonty or Phil or whoever, you can do this. You can do this stuff. You just got to start believing in yourself. And, you know, in some respects, suck it up, buck it up, it's going to hurt, which is fine. And that to me is absolutely critical to this. It's like, you can do this. And me saying, being, you know, we were the first para relay to cross the North Channel. That said, para swimmers can do this. You know, you can come into the North Channel. You know, I got into the North Channel. It was 11 degrees when I got in on my relay. You know, that's festive. That's festive temperatures. But we did it. You can do this. Being the first solo across the North, it means you can do this. Just find the right people. Find the people that will say to you, and help you and guide you and say, look, this is how I did it. Pick and choose from the bits that I did that work for you. Some things won't work out the bits, but you have to tell everybody else, because other people will then go, okay, if they can do it, and I've got a similar disability or a similar issue, and that's what they did, then I can do it. And, you know, cost is a big thing. And so I set up the Para 5, which is, you know, swim the channel, it's like £3,500-£4,000 plus. And that's just the English and the North. You go abroad, it's a, you know, it's considerably more. One of the big problems for disability UK period is that most people, you know, it costs more to be disabled in the UK, and on average they earn less if they're earning anyway, you know, if they're on benefits. So how do doing stuff like swimming channels is, for a lot of people, disabled people, it's just not on their radar, because it's just the cost is just outside of, it's just way outside of their capability. So I said, look, we need to come up with something that is cost friendly. So I came up with this concept of the Para 5. So it's five 5K swims in any pace. Just make sure it's accessible to you. If you can make one in the sea, brilliant. Jot down where the accessibility is, so other para swimmers who come and swim there, get them observed, sign them off. And it, you know, it'll cost you £25, because I've got to pay for the badge and the cap and the certificate. And that's what it, and we're I'm trying to promote that to give para swimmers something. You know, a 5K swim is a good shift. You know, it's a good swim. It's longer than an Ironman swim and all of that. So that's a, you know, that's a challenge. And then we're about to launch in the winter time the para icy 5, which will be 500 meter swims in 5 degrees or less. You can wear a wetsuit if you want, wear whatever is comfortable, but just go and swim. Go and swim with people who understand the ice and the cold, and go and achieve. You know, go and just promise. I promise you, you put a 500 meter ice badge on your changing robe. You know, people know that's a tough gig.
Yeah. And I mean, you're heavily involved in that accessibility for the countryside. You talked about swimming just then, but you're also involved with Open Country, which is about getting disabled people outdoors.
Yeah. So that's a charity set up in Harrogate. It's known as Harrogate's Best Kept Secret. It's been going 25 plus years, and I'm very proud to be a trustee of it. And what we do is try and get disabled people out into the countryside, whether that's doing tandem bike rides for blind clients, or they were out yesterday. I think they were renovating paths out in one of the woods, and they were laying down 5 tons of aggregate or whatever it was to widen the path, to make it more friendly for wheelchairs. And what we also do is that we have a pressure, you know, slight pressure group thing. So there are certain types of barriers that really do limit wheelchair users, and also probably mothers and fathers using prams and stuff like that. And there's some old ones that just are awful, and we try and get those taken out as well. We work with some of the cycling communities. We also do walks. And the big thing that they've started doing is getting them into blue space, and not just blue space, you know, like going to walks by rivers, but we're starting to get people into the rivers. And one of the things we're doing at Open Country, and we've been working with the University of York and St John, is trying to understand the whole field of what information is out there on for accessible into the blue space, and then create, then take what we do with Open Country, because one of the other things we do is if you're bringing, let's say, a disabled group up from the south to the north into Yorkshire, and you want to go and visit somewhere, we have packs that explain with maps all the information you need, all the paths, the gradients, how good they are, all of that. And what we're trying to do is take that into the open water, so that if a disabled swimmer is coming up with some friends in a swim group and they want to go to Knaresborough Lido, which is a favoured local swim spot, they can have the map. It's got a key that they understand, and they go, I can get in here. Because one of the most annoying things that happens for disabled swimmers, whether it's an organised event or not, but especially organised events, is you pay 30, 40, 50 quid to go and swim a 3K in one of the lakes in Windermere. And if you're in a wheelchair, you turn up and you can't get down to the waterside. And you may have come with your helper. So it's cost you 2 rail tickets, the event cost, and you're sitting there in your wheelchair 100 yards, and I always call it the last 100 yards, and I can't get, you know, you can't get access to the water. And then you take that one step further, and I'm standing on a box on this one, but beach access, you know, beach access for wheelchairs is atrocious in this country. It's starting in a few of them to address it. But, you know, it's not just about swimmers. It's about, you know, if you got mum and dad or granny and grandpa, and you want to spend the day on the beach with granny and grandpa, and one of them is in a wheelchair, you just can't do it with a wheelchair. And so I talk about this the hardest 100 yards is that bit from, you know, across the beach into the water, or just getting onto the beach. And what we're trying to do at Open Country is provide information and knowledge, and create, you know, a wave with a lot of other people who are looking at this as well. It's not just us, to say you need to start thinking about access to the water or onto the beaches for those who are less mobile, because it matters. And I think the one thing that lockdown showed is that having access to nature is really critical for our own minds, you know, for the good of our minds. So that's what we're trying to do, really, Open Country.
And interestingly, actually, when you put potentially land disabled individuals into the water, they actually they don't have to carry themselves in with the weight of water. So actually they are less disabled, or they're more
freedom.
Active in the water. Exactly. So that actually is almost more important.
Yeah.
Interestingly, I mentioned, obviously, got Greek roots, and go out to where my family's based in Greece, and there's, I think, three or four beaches that I can think of, and the island is tiny, that have accessible ramps for swimmers, and also one of them has blind boys.
Yeah, yeah.
But they do the noise so they can get in and out again. And that's just a tiny, tiny island. Obviously, tourism's a big part of it. But I've seen any of those in the Greek.
Greece, someone sent me a video of it's like a sliding. You sit on the chair and it takes you down.
Yeah, it's like, exactly. Yeah.
I'm actually going out to Greece on holiday in 3 weeks' time for a week to a place called Patmos, the island of Patmos, which looks absolutely lovely. Hopefully get some decent swims in. And everyone who showed me this stuff Greece seems to be where they're coming, you know, the chance you've seen it in Greece. And then I speak to the guide, you know, because as I said, I sit on Wowza, I sit on their inclusion advisory board as well as a couple of others. And, you know, the Americans, West Coast America has some options. And there's a lot of, you know, there are a lot of different options. The problem that you've got is, you know, it's infrastructure, it's cost to councils. And in a cost of living crisis and, you know, and an economy that's not necessarily firing on all cylinders, you know, budgets have to be drawn and, you know, and sadly this sort of stuff gets left behind. And what we need is, you know, the private sector needs to come in and pick this up. Local, you know, entrepreneurs, local successful business men and ladies to say, do you know what, we will sponsor this to get access for not just for disabled, but it's, you know, as I said, there's nothing that grandparents love more than being on the beach with their kids and the grandkids and having a day on the beach. And, you know, that last 100 yards is a really tough bit of access to get over.
And then I've got one last question before I go into the quick round side of things, but where do you see the future of para sport going?
I think it will end up in due course merging at some point. At some point, everyone, you know, I mean, I know it's a, you know, it's not the right, you know, it's not the probably it's not the most politically correct thing. But Oscar Pistorius, before he was an utter murdering freak, the one thing he did was show that the technology of these limbs that we rock, you know, we can get, is taking us closer and closer to parity. It isn't, trust me, running on a false leg really hurts and you lose a lot of energy, but he showed that there was a slight inkling of where we can get to. So I think there will be, you know, we want the technology, you know, I always call it the Terminator effect, will get us there, you know, the technology. And there's some really clever stuff coming out of the US, clever limbs, clever arm stuff coming out. So I think, you know, at some point we will end up merging, or they'll keep us apart because we'll be quicker. You know, there is that, you know, you know, there is that option. But, you know, the big thing in amputee world has always been, can you regrow limbs? And there is a logic that if we, you know, if we all came from amphibians and they can regrow limbs, and somewhere within our DNA you can manipulate it to start regrowing limbs. So, you know, at some point, I think there'll be more of a blended sport. And I think more and more para sport, you'll be able to do more things. You know, through the moment, and I need to get on probably on my high horses and start shouting at someone. There's no para open water master swimming. There's open water master swimming races for able bodies. I was doing the safety for them recently, but I'm not aware there's any para open water masters swimming. And I think people need to start looking, but they're not going to do anything unless there's a demand. And unless I, you know, people like me start saying, I want to come and race a 5K against another para swimmer. You know, can you just, we'll race with everybody else, but can we have a para medal? You know, I've been to plenty of events and there's no para medal. And of course, I'm never going to win because I'm not very good and I'm slow. But if I'm the only para there, give us a para medal. Because what it says is we recognize the para as a category and it will encourage para people to come, because they'll go, okay, I don't need to race against able bodies to get a medal. I can race against Jonty and I'll beat him because he's slow and old. You know, and that does slightly annoy me. is that I go to events and in some respects we need to pick it up in the ice world as well, because I've been to a number of ice events where there's no paramedals and I'm like, come on guys, you know, get on the program.
I mean, it does bring in people, doesn't it? If you know you're gonna get a cool shiny medal at the end of an event, that's always going to be a pull, because you've got something to talk about.
Exactly. Yeah.
Jonty, thank you very much. I'm going to go through. We've got a few questions. We'll just do quick fire answers for them, and then we'll call there. But first of all, what does Believe, Strive, Achieve mean to you, and how is it applied to your experiences?
I think Believe is believe in yourself, and believe it's open as a Paris person. I believe it's open to me. Strive is the bit that you need to do. It's the bit down in the darkened gym that I have at home that is where you put in the shift to actually then achieve. And that's what it means to me. It's that I can do this, but I need to strive to do it in order to achieve and be of equal to non-para athletes, whatever we're calling ourselves today.
The next one I'm very interested in, because you mentioned Pauline a couple of times, but what is the measure of a good coach or indicator of a good coach for you?
Someone who recognises the potential within you and presents what they need you to do in a manner to which you can engage with, rather than this, I've always taught it this way, it doesn't work for me. You know, that doesn't work for me. I'm a doer. You know, I need to do, and then you need to tell me what I'm doing is wrong. Or other people go very technical and all that. So it's all about personalization to the swimmer, to the cyclist, to the runner. The job of the coach is to get the best out of their potential.
Aside from what Penny says, is there anything that you wouldn't do?
Sport.
So Everest is off.
Yeah, so the deal with Penny, right, is no Everest. That's now crept into all high mountains, because I fancied going up the Eiger, and apparently that's a no. There's a swim that I would love to do with my swim partner Jackie called the Korovecan Whirlpool Swim. That's banned. I'm trying to work on Penn for that, but apparently that's not going to happen. It's still banned. There's a swim, the most dangerous channel swim is the Farral Island Swim off the west coast of America, and I personally would not do that, because if you read the guidebook, it basically says if you dip your toe into this water, you're going to get eaten by a great white shark. Simple as it. Three people have swum it ever. I wouldn't do it.
Sounds sensible. That's the logical side of your brain coming over and again, isn't it?
Yeah.
What would be your favorite race that you've done so far, or is there a bucket list event that you've
the bucket list event that I want to do is this downhill one in Finland. My favourite swim that I've done so far, apart from all my ice, I swim in this place in the south of France, and on the surface, it's a dangerous swim because it's a canyon swim. So I swim up the Gorge de Verdun, which has got like 1,000-foot limestone cliffs next to you. It's where Top Gear did the race around versus the climber, and there's a river that you swim up. Well, there's not many people that do it, and I swim up there. That is my favourite swim in the whole wide world, but it is dangerous because there's nowhere to get out. But I do it because I know what I'm doing. I don't recommend it.
And what's been your best sporting memory?
Oh God, I'm lucky. I've got so many. You know, first time I got powder skiing was fantastic. The ice fall by 250, doing my ice mile. The relay swim with Team Bits Missing across the North Channel with 5 amputees, all left leg amputees. Some of us knew each other and we didn't realise it from before. One of Mary's brother used to teach me, and we did it on the 20th or the 22nd of June, which was exactly the same 22nd of June, 6 years earlier, the first disabled relay went across the English Channel. Doing the first That Bit's Missing relay was a massive, massive achievement. Obviously, my solo North Channel was massive as well. There's a rugby match at school that I played in that still, you know, was just my last rugby match ever at school was just joyful. Playing with my mates, it was just fabulous. So yeah, I am lucky. I've got a lot.
Certainly do. Jonty, thank you very much
for
your time. Thank you very much for your your sense of adventure and inspiration as well, because it's I think regardless of the fact that you are an amputeed swimmer, you actually probably would have done some pretty incredible sporting achievements, maybe not on the rugby field, but other ways as well, because it's you definitely got that mentality. So thank you very much for your insights.
Thank you.
Really, really interesting.
Philip, what a great episode we had here with Jonty. What are your thoughts about this one? It was quite impressive, I have to tell you.
Yeah, I think this is a really impressive conversation. Jonty, I think, would have been a fantastic endurance athlete, regardless of whether or not he had all of his limbs. He clearly had that drive and that ability to do crazy endurance activities. But I think what is remarkable or fascinating is that he's almost used himself as a platform to really try and do more and do good with that. And actually, that's at the heart of a lot of what we talk about with athletes. We recognize, if athletes can recognize that they are role models, and it might be to the scale that Jonty is, where clearly he's pulling people around him and leading them and to do some amazing things, be that the first mixed relay at the Ice Mile Championships. It doesn't matter. Like, it could be something like that, or it can be something as simple as going out for a run in front of your children, so they see that fitness is a fundamental part of movement is a fundamental part of being human. I think if people could start recognizing that if they become a role model, they can make a big difference to other people, they find that their ability to do more becomes easier. And I think Jonty's life, essentially, the way he does things is obviously amplified. And we can see that being an amplified version of that. But I think that's really at core of what we see, that great endurance athletes are doing things because there's a bigger cause beyond just their own race, which they want to try and do. They're trying to make a big difference for them in a small scale. They recognize themselves as role models.
So do you think that he's a very good example of lead by example?
I think he's had to, because I think he's obviously dived into an environment where there aren't many people doing what he wants to do. Certainly not many people who are also para-athletes as well. And so he's had to lead by example, and I think it's a strength of his own character, which has allowed him to do that where other people may not have been able to. So I don't know if it's a direct link to say, oh, it's a lead by example thing, or if it is more of a, I guess, the right person in the right place kind of conversation.
What do you think was the biggest lesson we can take from this episode?
I think it's that recognizing that everyone's a role model. I think the biggest lesson that anyone can take is that if you can find a greater purpose, you'll find a greater way of doing, and you'll find a solution, you'll find a way. Would that be the main one? And then the kind of the underlying tones of, well, why not? What's stopping you from doing something? Just because someone says you can't doesn't mean that you can't. It just means that you can't do it that way. So there's always a solution. You just need to find it. And I think if people have that determination and grit to do that, they'll find they can go a long way.
I agree. This is already a long episode. Thank you so much for this one. It was a very good lesson. And I think we can all learn with his example.
Thank you very much, Diego. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from this. So if anyone wants more information around any of the areas, be it ice swimming, para swimming, the charity work which Jonty was involved with, we put the links into the show notes at the bottom. So feel free to browse that or drop him or us a message.
Thank you so much.
The Believe, Strive, Achieve podcast is produced every week for your enjoyment, and show notes are found at trytrainingharder.com. Come back often and feel free to add the podcast to your favorite RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Try Training Harder. Thanks for listening!